Welcome to Leadership Beyond the Trenches. I'm your host, Anne Reifenstein, and today I'm going to share a conversation that I had with Major General Craig Acheson. General Acheson is the commander of the Canadian Defense Academy, and as such, he's got a really, really broad mandate when it comes to training, education, and organizing what that's going to look like for the Canadian Armed Forces. We talked a lot about institutional leadership. He talked a lot about his organization and how it's implicated in developing leaders. So I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. Welcome, Major General Acheson. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me on this. I'm really excited to have a chance to discuss education with you because you've got a whole bunch of really interesting backgrounds, you know, with your background with the U.S. Army in Alaska and then doing the SAMS program down in the States and now being, you know, in charge of the Canadian Defense Academy. I'm really curious as to, you know, your thoughts on institutional leadership. Would you mind just introducing yourself and giving me a bit of background?
So, and right, so Major General Craig Acheson, the commander of the Canadian Defense Academy. So, as you said, I've spent a lot of time in the individual training and education world. And like you, it's because I'm passionate about it. I taught my first course as a lieutenant, and then my second course also as a lieutenant, where I taught an infantry section commander's course. And from there, I served time at the tactics school, the officer candidate school, the leadership and recruit school, commanded the infantry school, commanded combat training center, was a seminar leader at SAMS, and then did collective training for 2 years in Alaska as the Deputy Commanding General for Operations, and now find myself in charge of the institution and subordinate institutions that deliver the professional development for the members of the profession of arms. And so when I was offered this job, it was a very easy answer because I love what it is that we do. And the ability to influence the future of that, how we get truly into the 21st century delivery of professional development and particularly PME, but also education more broadly with RMC Saint-Jean and then the self-development pillar. So all that to say is super excited to be in this role and thank you for taking the time to spend some time with me today because I'm excited about this conversation.
Well, you know, you've just described spending a lot of time teaching people how to lead and leading people who are teaching people how to lead. How's your own leadership style evolved over time?
When I got promoted colonel, actually, down in Kansas, my dad came down. He was the colonel of the regiment of the RCR at the time. And one of the things I said there as he was helping to preside over the ceremony was, I learned more from my father about leadership than anybody else probably in my military career. He retired as an RCR colonel. He had a very personal approach to leadership and just watching him and hearing his stories and watching him look after people, that was kind of that foundational piece of the approach that I think I have adopted. It's certainly how I feel I lead. And so for me, it's very personal, right? It's about people, this business that we're in. And I think what, you know, to answer your question directly, how's it evolved over the course of my career? I think it's a question of less about competence perhaps and more about confidence, right? And then perhaps the ability to influence and having more to offer. And so while there's no question that I've learned about leadership through the course of my career, as a young captain at the officer candidate school, where you're teaching leadership theory, it really forces you to think about how you do that. And so I think early on, I had at least the baseline skills and knowledge, but with confidence, I think, and championing the things that leaders need to be able to champion. And then over time, as I've learned how much influence leaders and commanders have when they're put into positions of influence, and how you use that to promote organizational objectives is really, I think, what's evolved over time. I don't know that my approach has evolved, although the shift from personal leadership and kind of tactical leadership into institutional leadership, clearly the approach has to evolve because there are different levers at your disposal understanding governance and process and all this in the institutional leadership role is important. It's not fundamentally different. I still exercise personal leadership every day. I still have people around me that need to be led. And then the last point that I think we have more to offer the longer we're in uniform at any rank level, it comes with experience, not necessarily with positions of authority, but you learn a lot over the course of a career. I've been in uniform for my 36th year, and I've had a lot of really, really good examples of leadership through that time and some maybe less good examples of leadership, but we learn from all of them. And so I think we have more to offer the more senior we get, because we just comes back to influence, but equally we're in positions where we can make a difference in people's lives. And I think that's really what's evolved over the course of the last, three and a half decades.
It's interesting that you say that it makes a difference in people's lives. That's really a point that resonates with me, because that's one of the best parts, in my opinion, of leadership. How do you take that when you go and work in another army? Because you just came from Alaska, where you were working in the U.S. Army. I don't know how many Canadians are in that particular area, but when you're working in another military, how does that translate? Does it need to be translated? Is it the same?
No, it does need to be translated. And in fact, as I was, when I came back from Kansas, actually, after 2 years down there, I found myself in the Army headquarters and discovered that I was simultaneously translating everything in my head from Canadian into American and then back into Canadian for the first several months. And I wasn't really aware of that there was that continuous translation going on into the U.S. Vocabulary and ideas and the cultural frames of reference and all that until I came back. I said to people, I'm not slow. I'm just translating kilometers to miles back to kilometers, and that takes time. But kind of the principle of your question, I think the Canadian style of leadership and the Canadian military culture is a really, really good one. I think, we're more welcoming. We have this diverse view of the world that other nations don't necessarily have. And so I don't think I changed my leadership approach when I was outside of Canada, whether that was at SAMS or in Iraq before I was in Alaska or in Alaska. And I can say that with my hand on my heart, because a lot of people would make the comment about me being different and me having a different style. And I don't think that was just because Craig Aitchison was different than the people around him. I think it comes back to our national values, our national culture, our military culture is a subculture of that, and so on. And then part of that maybe is Craig Aitchison. There were no other Canadians in U.S. Army Alaska. There were no other non-Americans in U.S. Army Alaska. But there were other Canadians in Anchorage at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Largely Air Force, and so different subculture again, and different approach to leadership and operations. And I won't say who my counterpart was. I have great respect for him, but him and I were very different. And he super animated, super black and white, and superbly competent. And in fact, was promoted out of that job and went on to bigger and better things as well. But him and I were very different. But him and I were more alike than perhaps we were to our counterparts in the U.S. Military. And I think that's because we're Canadian. And I think that diversity, that different view that we bring to the multinational team is hugely important. And I think that's one of the reasons we have these exchanges. I mean, you lived it down in the States too. And, the value of a Canadian at the Command General Staff College or in U.S. Army Alaska is the different lens through which we see the world, the difference in doctrine that we have to process ourselves. Why is our doctrine different? Why are we different? That really forces us to be a little introspective, but also brings value in that conversation that we have with our colleagues, our students, our superiors, our subordinates, and gives them a different frame of reference. And I believe, because I think, again, what the Canadian brings to that conversation makes them, because Canadians are awesome, makes them better.
talked about values and traits, you know, of a leader, acceptance of diversity, that embracing of diversity. What are other traits and other things that you think are important to institutional leaders?
Well, for institutional leaders in particular, you know, different than tactical leaders in some respects, right? I think there's certainly similarity and commonality between the two, because I think good leaders are good leaders, right? And I think when I think about those two, for me, the two principles of leadership that resonate most deeply with me that apply regardless of whether you're an institutional or personal, you know, tactical leader were lead by example and look out for the welfare of our subordinates. Because even as an institutional leader, you have those responsibilities. But more directly to your question, you know, I was reading through this week as we get ready for the executive leaders program next week, where we'll spend some time with the newest general officers and flag officers in the Canadian Armed Forces and the most senior chief warrant officers and chief petty officers first class as they go into their new appointments. And some of the readings from Harvard Business Review, as an example, are about strategic leadership. And I won't bore you with what the details are. Fascinating reads, but they resonate very much with one of the key takeaways that I took away from my time at SAMS. And that's the commander's role in campaign planning. And there's a six-letter acronym that aligns really closely with this one HBR article. So I think it aligns very neatly with the role of the institutional leader. And that is the six roles of the commander in campaign planning are understanding, visualization, decide, direct, lead, and assess. Right? So UBDDLA. And when I think about that and the responsibility of that institutional leader to provide vision, right? And that's one of the roles when I look at our doctrine, that's one of the roles of a strategic leader. Before you can provide that vision or visualization, you need to understand, right? And so you need to therefore be, you have to have a level of humility that allows you to come into an organization that you may not fully understand and take time to understand it. The first 90 days or so in any job, especially as you get higher up, the more complex it becomes. Before you start providing your vision and providing direction, you kind of need to understand what the spaces you're in. And I don't just mean, in this case, the Canadian Defense Academy, but the strategic space that CDA sits in. You know, it's got the interest of the vice, it's got the interest of the chief of defense, the interest of the Canadian Armed Forces chief warrant officer and the councils that they sit on and on and on. And so you need to understand this complex organism that you live in. But then your responsibility is to take that understanding and visualize and describe that visualization for your people to then figure out where they fit within it, to figure out where you're charting this path from where you are to where you want to be. You know, the level of humility to acknowledge that you don't know everything. When you look at the complexity of the organization, there are going to be people within your organization that have a far deeper understanding of parts of it that you will ever have. And you have to be humble enough to accept that and then leverage them and their knowledge and make them powerful within the contribution. Before you get to that point, I think you have to have this level of self-awareness and motivation to your own self-development to be able to have that level of, to gain that level of understanding, because I think those are related and probably interdependent on achieving that level of understanding is a sense of who you are and how you learn and you taking your time to develop your own understanding and your own level of expertise before you, again, provide that visualization and before you start making decisions and providing direction, right? I mean, those are the first four key steps in campaign planning. And I think they apply equally to institutional leadership. What you need to bring to the table as that most senior leader is a systems thinking approach, you know, working in wholes, holism, having holistic views of organizations and seeing the interdependencies and interconnectedness between all of those nodes. And so using CDA again as an example, you know, Royal Military College of Canada here in Kingston has initiatives, have challenges, have all sorts of things that exist in that framed ecosystem. Everything we do in RMC ought to be considered as we look at RMC Saint-Jean, right? They're not the same, but we need to look at them more broadly as an organism, and then zoom back out and say, you know, the Canadian Forces College and l'Institut Suicide, they should also be considered in that broader framework. And so the commander's job, the senior leader or institutional leader's job, is to see the interconnectednesses of all of that and then connect those dots to say, okay, here's the organizational approach to this, because I've seen an example at the tactical level what works, and make sure it can come out of that nascent sort of petri dish and really flourish in the broader organization. So systems thinking has got to be a big part of it. I think understanding levels of influence and levers of influence, you know, how does the world work? How does Ottawa work? How does the department work? That's part of what I bring to the fight, understanding where we connect into chief force development, right? So if we're responsible for the professional development of the members of the profession of arms, and he's responsible for acquiring new capabilities, well, we got to make sure the profession of arms is capable of delivering the effect with that equipment. And so understanding the levers of change and where we have a role, elevating organizational understanding, making sure that the organization knows where we are in the big picture so that they can contextualize what they do. Otherwise, you got people working 9 to 5 who come in and, you know, move paper from left to right, and they're a cog in a larger machine. And if they understand what that larger machine is and the impact it has on the organization, then they'll presumably be more motivated to come to work every day and really understand where they fit in. And then finally, where all of that fits into the really big picture, government policy, defense policy, nation to nation relationships, both as opportunities and then limitations. So a couple of days ago, I had a phone call with Major General Carignan over in Iraq. And the next phone call is going to be with my counterpart in the Iraqi Ministry of Defense to figure out how CDA and the Iraqi equivalent work together to promote the development of the profession in Iraq. And that nests very neatly within the strong, secure, engaged defense policy, and quite neatly within where ADM policy and Government of Canada see the Canadian-Iraqi relationship. So this institutional leader needs to be able to connect all of those dots in order to give the organization purpose and unity of effort.
It's interesting that you say looking at it from a whole. What would you say is your role in shaping the organizational culture? You've talked about the functional bits and connecting the dots there, but how do you see your role is in shaping the organizational culture?
Yeah, so that's hard, eh? Culture change, senior leaders are in positions for fixed, relatively limited periods of time. And there's a bunch of ways that I think we affect culture. One of it just goes back to leading by example. There are cultural norms that we have in the Canadian Armed Forces. Fitness is one. And so one of the ways I think we influence a senior leader's culture is by leading by example, right? How you treat people, how you talk about others outside of the organization, how you carry yourself, how you interact with the organization, how do you communicate within your organization? And of course, in this particular pandemic environment, that's not easy. And so you have to leverage virtual ways, virtual town halls, emails out to the team. But at the end of the day, culture, especially culture change and organizational change, people have to be bought into the vision. And one of the ways we do that, and certainly one of the ways I have always approached it, and we've already had our first strategic planning session about 6 weeks ago. We sat down with all the senior folks, the senior commanders, their senior staffs, the staff from the headquarters, and we talked about the approach that I want to take. And it was by design, collaborative, transparent. We talked about big ideas, you know, because if you get the big ideas right, then the organization can reorient onto the small ideas, right? You can empower your subordinates, mission command, all the philosophies that we talk about. And so all of those things are ways in which certainly I try to influence organizational culture and change within it. So I just submitted last week my 60-day assessment to my boss and to the vice. And it was 7 pages of observation and acknowledgement of here's some of the challenges that we face and priority. And then the last page and a half or 2 pages was, this is where I want to be. Right? This, all this core business stuff is stuff I need to do as an L2. But this is where CDA needs to be in the future. Before I hit send on that, I pushed it out to the, you know, what I call the brain trust of the organization. I said, here's my thinking, right? And we have had a series of conversations, but they get a voice. And giving them a voice, I think, is incredibly important in evolving a culture, organizational culture, because it's easy to alienate people through lack of transparency, lack of collaboration, lack of open, all those things that I think are so important. Because I go back to a comment I made earlier, you don't have the ability to know everything there is to know about the organization. We're not here long enough. We don't have the bandwidth to absorb it all. We're distracted by both the vision piece, where do I want to be 90, 180, 270 days from now, as well as the what's in my face space, you know, the challenges of organizations, misconduct and administration and, you know, just the day-to-day stuff. And so empowering, giving a voice to people, collaborating, seeking their input, to me is one of those ways of influencing organizations, whether it's the culture or the change agenda or whatever.
It's interesting that you say that. Leading by example is something that keeps coming up in some way or another as so important for institutional leaders, providing that role modeling. The other way the CAF indoctrinates people is through socialization, the entry-level stuff into the organizational culture. How do you see that relationship? Because that a lot of that through RMC and RMC Saint-Jean or CMR, that's where a lot of that socialization goes. Does that need to be shaped into the future? How do you see your role as an institutional leader shaping that space? Or does it need to be? You know, is that something that's too far away from Commander CDA?
No, in fact, it should be front and center, I think, with what my role is, right? Is, you know, so I go back to we're rewriting duty with honor. And if duty with honor is the way that we capture our culture and our expectations and our norms, then that is central to what CDA should be fascinated by. And we are. When we look at kind of what Milpers Gen Group does in the attraction space and the recruiting space, those first interactions with Canadians as we go to seek them to come in or at least consider coming in. And then once they're in, you know, how do we do that? And should we? Absolutely, we should. And we do. And so, you know, using the military colleges, the two Royal Military Colleges here in Kingston and Saint-Jean, they do their first year orientation program, and they did that this year, despite COVID. They did that this year, despite those first year students not going to CFLRS first.
And just for clarification, the CFLRS stands for the Canadian Forces Leadership and Recruiting School. It's where basic training takes place and is usually the entry point for everyone coming into the CAF.
And the reason is because this isn't, you know, pick a small town university. You know, this is a university with a difference, right? That's our tagline. That's our, we believe it. And the differences go back to the four pillars of what that degree program means.
So the four pillars that he's referring to is part of the degree program at the military colleges. And the four pillars are academics, military training, bilingualism, and fitness. And for students to be successful at the Royal Military College, they have to be able to succeed in all four of those different areas.
But it goes back to the values of the Canadian Armed Forces and how do we inculcate those and socialize those to those young Canadians as they come in. I think a lot of people believe that that's a process that takes weeks. And the sad facts are that it's not. It's a process that takes years. And sometimes, you know, some maybe decades before people truly understand what it is that we're asking of them. But I think it starts at attraction. It certainly starts at recruiting. And then as they come in through that first developmental period of their careers, across all four pillars, the training pillar has a clear role in inculcation. CFLRS is a huge part of that. The education pillar here in the two military colleges, the two junior military colleges, as I call them, is absolutely part of that. And I'll tell you that, I spent a lot of time talking with both Seb Bouchard, the commandant here in Kingston, and Nick Pilon, the commandant in RMC Saint-Jean, and their two chiefs, both of whom are tremendous. But, you know, I talk to directors of cadets regularly to at least have a dialogue open to understand their business, right? Because at the end of the day, their business is my business. I am constantly, refreshingly happy to see the amount of effort that goes into that. And so just a quick example here in Kingston, I would offer that General Bouchard is probably the most present RMC commandant in a while. He is out and about all the time. He is down and in. He is focused on his students and the welfare of his students. If a student has a family crisis, if a student has a death in the family, he goes to see that student personally in the evening to make sure they're okay. He is making sure that the quality of life, especially in this pandemic environment, meets his students' needs in a way that is beyond a commandant's way. He does it as a father because three of his children have or are in the military college system, but he does it because he's a good leader. And so I have great confidence in him and Karina Heilman as his director of cadets that they live and breathe that socialization, that leadership by example at their level every single day. And I have tons of stories not even 3 months, 2.5 months in command that I could tell about how they do that. And not just at RMC Saint-Jean and RMC here in Kingston, CFC, OSIT Institute, it's all the same, right? These folks that command and lead and inculcate the values at those different developmental periods are invested in the profession. And I often, I ask people, a couple of weeks ago, we received the outcome of a StatsCan survey on sexual misconduct in the Canadian military colleges. We asked for that. We asked to participate. We asked to have the data so we would have a baseline reading and we will act on that data. But as we were reviewing the outcome of it and reviewing the statistics, some of them were a bit alarming. We had this conversation about compliance and commitment. In the first development period of any soldier's life, whether you're a soldier, sailor, aviator, officer, NCO, whatever, it's largely compliant based, right? Here are the rules that we expect you to abide by. Here's our code of values. And this is how we expect you to carry yourself. And we expect you to comply with that, right? Because they're not yet committed to this idea. They've bought into it enough to enroll. But at some point in your professional development, that transitions to commitment, right? You're bought into the organization. You are now part of the institution. And I believe for officers and NCOs, it's around the same point in time. It's around DP3. Where you are in for the long haul and you're committed. And so that early socialization really is to get people through to commitment, right? Past compliance, but it's to get you into the space, to give you the information you need, to build your understanding, to change your behavior so that you understand what we need you to do. And then we've got all sorts of levers if you can't, but we can retrain, we can re-educate and eventually release. And if that's what has to happen, then that's fine. But eventually we want you to just to be committed, right? We want you to be committed to the values that we represent. But that first step is critical. And those NCOs and junior officers that I used to be one of, right, when I was at Officer Candidate School, that interface is so influential. And that goes back to personal leadership, right? And leading by example and what we're trying to teach at that level. It applies equally in an educational setting as it does in the training setting.
It's interesting that you referred to it as compliance and then commitment. I had it explained to me as less pleasantly, but as mercenary and then missionary and then back to mercenary. So that's the three stages of your career. You join for mercenary reasons. It's a transactional relationship. Then it's missionary because you're a believer, you're committed, you're in there. And then at the end of your career, you kick back at some point to being mercenary. And everybody's point is different there. I like yours better. I like, you know, compliance and then commitment. That sounds much nicer. That's interesting on the front end. So well, let's talk about the middle and as we develop, and let's talk a little bit about the profession of arms and the role of the institutional leader in stewarding the profession of arms, because that's really something, it's a difficult thing to get a handle on. It's such a, when we say profession of arms, we're talking such a broad scope and interpreted broadly and differently. So I was just wondering, what's your take on stewarding the profession of arms?
You know, so if you had asked me that question a year ago, I would maybe have, because of role, not necessarily because of belief, I would probably have a different answer. But now that my role clearly aligns with that stewardship and responsibility, certainly I look at it through a different lens today. You know, when I think about my role, part of it goes to the, you know, something, I'm the guardian of the professional development framework. That is, to me, that's clear. And that framework is, you know, it's that Greek sort of building model that we use that has the four pillars that support it. And right now as CDA, I own a lever in three of the four very directly, and that's training, education, and self-development. And then the fourth one's experience, that I have a role in the sense that I take people with experience and I put them through one of the other three pillars, and then kick them back to gain experience before they come back in again. And so I think my role isn't to synchronize all of that, although I would love to be able to, right? Because if everything's an input process output kind of way of looking at things, then I take folks off the street, I give them some training, and I kick out a trained soldier to a line unit. And that line unit gives them experience. And then at some point, they'll give them back to me for some professional military education, maybe some little bit of PLQ.
PLQ stands for Primary Leadership Qualification. It's the first leadership course that most soldiers take.
And then I kick them back out as a leader. And then they gain some experience. And then they come back. I would love to be involved in all four of those, but don't. You know, not directly. But that's one of the conversations I really look forward to with the L1s, right? And DGMC.
So just a bit of clarification on the reference to L1. L1 refers to the level of the organization within the Department of National Defense. L0 is at the top. L1's the next level down. The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, they're all considered L1 organizations. L2 organizations are those organizations that are within the L1s. It's an institutional short form to refer to what level organization you're talking about. Director General Military Careers, or DGMC, is basically the head career manager for all of the Canadian Armed Forces career managers. Those are the people that control postings and promotions and things like that. And they're the ones who do all the administrative management of that area.
But that's one of the conversations I really look forward to with the L1s, right? And DGMC facilitates that movement between the pillars, because I think that's important. I think that there needs to be a common understanding of what that experience pillar should look like, as an example, right? We know what the training pillar looks like. We have qualification standards and training plans, and we have officer general specifications and NCM general specifications that tell us what they need to be able to do, and we build training to make them be able to do that, et cetera. But we don't have the equivalent for experience. We expect leaders and commanders to take their kind of output requirements and then build teams and people who can deliver that output. But I think as it relates to, again, back to my role in particular as CDA, it's making sure that the conditions exist for all of those, especially the three pillars, to thrive and provide the members of the profession of arms the opportunities, the knowledge and the skills to be able to do what it is that we're asking them to do. right? So the ethical framework for them to operate independently in an adaptive dispersed operation where they are alone and unafraid in the middle of nowhere, and they're confronted with a moral or ethical dilemma, and they know what to do. And part of that is education, part of that is training, part of that is, you know, providing the literature for them to read on their own and as they develop themselves under that self-development pillar. And so as I look at the enterprise that delivers that on my behalf, I have some ideas on how, you know, how that looks. But equally, in conversation, you know, so the chief of defense clearly is the at the top end of that professional development framework responsibility, that stewardship. And to him through the vice, I am responsible to deliver on his behalf. And more recently, so the Armed Forces Management Board, Armed Forces Council, Armed Forces Council Executive are the forums within which we're talking about. And the L1 commanders are engaged. And so what I'm kind of working through now cognitively is, how do I engage with them in a truly meaningful way in order to be able to do my role? Because we all have a role. We all have a stewardship role. We're all there to protect the institution, to set the conditions for the institution's success down the road, and to make sure that the soldiers, sailors, aviators, and special operators within the broader CAF framework are prepared to do what our nation asks them to do. Part of my role is that sort of conceptual CDA, profession of arms responsibility. And then the other role that I have is as an L2, as a commander of a level 2 organization, is to compete for the resources to be able to deliver on the former, right? Is the business planning process and getting the decisions to actually affect change in the professional military education realm. You know, as we evolve the National Security Studies program, what does that look like in 23, 24? I'll tell you, it's going to look different than it did last year. But I can't do that without going through a process to get the buy-in, to get the guidance, and so on. How I separate those two core business, those two roles, that core business, L2, oversight of L3s, with that intellectual, conceptual thinking about the profession is one of the challenges I face. Because the first one's easy to argue for, right? It's easy for me to argue for money for a program. It's difficult for me to argue for resources to think about thinking in an environment where resources are tight. But that's where I think CDA needs to be, because I think we need to wrap our heads around what it is we're being asked to do and how the future looks, so that when we get to that future, the members of the Canadian Armed Forces, the profession of arms, are actually ready to do that. Those are the kinds of conversations we have in the hallways of CDA.
Well, that's critical, right? Because I can't see doing one without doing the other. You can't be arguing, competing for resources unless you've got the buy-in from the institution writ large that those resources are going to be effectively used to support them. Because in essence, that's what the education program does, is it supports their delivery of those capabilities and effects.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, the old saying, right, your perspective depends on where you sit. And so, you know, if you're the commander of the Army, and this is a terrible example because General Ayer is a huge supporter of PD and PME, but your in-your-face problem is generating forces for expeditionary and domestic operations. And that's a collective and individual training remit. He hopes that my side of the ship, my part of the ship is sound, and then we're producing the leaders he needs. But he is day-to-day focused on his part of the ship. And so as you get higher and higher up into the organization at the top of the pyramid, and you get to the chief of defense, right? He's the guy who's trying to synchronize everything. So you go down one level to the L1s, kind of the Armed Forces Management Board level. And that's where those conversations need to take place. It's like, here's how I see my side of the ship kind of working. And if you agree, then here's the resource bill that comes with that. There's a decision maker in the Canadian Armed Forces who decides where money goes and where resources go. And you hope that you get the apportionment of the resources that you need in order to deliver on that second part of the program. You know, most organizations in the Canadian Armed Forces today are resourced to deliver on what they need to do now. there's a risk calculus that we go through, and but generally speaking, I think we're kicking out what we need to be able to kick out. Are we investing in tomorrow? That question is a little more difficult. And that's where CDAs, that's where that non-L2 function is, right? So I can deliver, CFC can deliver JCSP, NSP, and CSSP. We got that.
All of those acronyms refer to programs that are run at the Canadian Forces College.
But can they deliver it in a way, can they evolve it in a way that we need to for the future needs of the profession of arms? That's a different problem. And that's where CDA's more ethereal conceptual role is, right? Is setting those conditions for the future. And so what's the educational framework look like? What's the pedagogical framework look like? What's the information technology framework need to look like? What are the underpinning doctrinal foundations that we build on? You know, and then you get into curriculum development and you actually deliver a program. But that front end piece is what CDA needs to be thinking about every day. That's more difficult to argue for resources for because it's squishy.
It's interesting that you say that because I actually was, you know, reading one of my students writing about this exact thing today, actually, as I was assessing what he was posting. And one of the things they were talking about is the in-house delivery of this type of thing, vice the outsourcing. So right now we're looking and we deliver the majority of this in-house, you know, have our own programs and everything else. What about outsourcing some of this? What about drawing on and plugging into the larger Canadian society to assist in developing these educational resources? Is that something that people are looking at or is, you know, how, or does that undermine our profession of arms concept?
Well, in some respects, we already outsource, right? So, you know, you taught ILE outside of Canada. There's an example of where we're sending Canadian students to the U.S. to learn. I did my DP4 outside of Canada. I taught DP3 outside of Canada too. So there's all sorts of ways that we're doing that already. And I don't know what the math would say, but I think maybe half of our NSP graduates come from a non-Canadian institution. When I think about all of those that go to the service war colleges and then go to NDU and ICAF and then, you know, outside the U.S., it's probably 60-40 Canadian, non-Canadian, maybe closer to 50-50. So we already outsource a lot of it. But that's about diversity goals, right? That's about, it's about networking. It's about building understanding of how our partners, key allies work. It's not necessarily leveraging capacity that exists for the purpose of capacity. But to your point, so a part of CDA includes the Center for National Security Studies. And part of Queen's includes the Center for International Defense Policy. And so one of the question, you know, lines of conversation that we've been having recently is, how does CNSS partner with like-minded security studies organizations in order to help drive the thinking that leads to curriculum change, that leads to the change, right? So I think that's an area in which we can begin to lean on external partners. And there are tons of them. There's hundreds of them. In fact, this morning I spent a few hours online with the Partnership for Peace Consortium, which is exactly that with international partners and allies. It was a spinoff of the NATO PFP. It's connected into the Marshall Center. It's connected into the U.S. DOD. It's connected into CDA. It's connected into the British-German Defense Academies. Like it's a pretty robust organization. And they look at some of these problem sets that the profession of arms deals with. And so there are working groups. One of those working groups is on security sector reform. That working group looks at things like human security and women, peace and security, women and children in operations and so on, which is part of programs that we deliver. And so we can leverage in that way contemporary thinking about that broader subject of human security. And bring it into our curriculum with a relatively modest investment because it's a networked multinational effort that we're already plugged into. And so those are all ways in which we can absolutely leverage some of that external capacity. And then the other is by bringing in external experts into the organization for short to medium term investment, right? So if I bring a contractor in for 6 weeks to help me frame a particular problem that informs how we do professional development, then that is one of the ways that we outsource solutions as well. And then as you and I were talking earlier offline, there's this network of podcasters out there who are curating content that if we were able to harness that horsepower in a way to help inform thinking, right? And then in turn inform content that it informs the future of the profession of arms and what we believe and think and how we act and so on, then we do. And one of the ways in a resource limited environment is we're going to figure out how we leverage that to our benefit.
That seems like a really positive note to wrap up our chat on, sir. Just looking towards the future and ways to leverage and improve the professional military education of members of the Canadian Armed Forces. I'd just like to say thanks so much for taking the time, talking with me so frankly and openly about your thoughts on institutional leadership and your thoughts on what Commander CDA is bringing to the table. I really appreciate your time. So thanks very much, Major General Aitchison. You got as much out of this conversation as I did. I really enjoyed talking with General Aitchison. It was a really interesting conversation with someone who's looking to keep the good stuff that the CAF does and to look to improve and make it even better. So I really had a great time having this conversation and I really learned a lot. So thanks for joining us and I hope that you'll listen again. Leadership Beyond the Trenches is hosted and produced by Anne Reifenstein, with theme music provided by Mikhail Hellman under Creative Commons licensing.